Hi, I'm David Shipler.
And I'm Daniel Zwerdling. Two reporters start now.
One of the most chilling images during the COVID pandemic for me was that video on television of cars lined up, snaking through streets for a long, long time, full of people who needed food. And they were getting food from a food pantry or a food bank somewhere because their jobs went away and they were unable to afford food. They needed it for their kids.
I was going to use that exact same word, chilling. This is the United States of America.
I think we have to remember that while the pandemic made everything worse, it didn't invent brand new problems in the hunger category. I mean, this is a chronic problem for low-income families.
So we got in touch with a doctor who works with children and their families who are hungry. And she introduced us to some of her patients.
What the picture of that looks like is kids who are not just underweight, but who are stunted in their growth. Kids that meet the World Health Organization definition of malnutrition and yet are in the United States of America.
Dr. Megan Sandal is a pediatrician. She's now co-director of the GROW Clinic at Boston Medical Center. It was founded almost 40 years ago now by a doctor named Deborah Frank. They treat children who are diagnosed with what doctors call failure to thrive.
And before we get to Megan, Dave, you've dug up some pretty amazing statistics. Horrendous.
This is not just a marginal issue in the United States. And during normal times, not the pandemic, but normal times, the percentage of families with children who suffer from what's called food insecurity, that is, sometimes or often they do not have enough money to buy food, runs 13 to 21% of households with children.
And that's millions of people.
Tens of millions. Well, during the pandemic, as of last fall, it was about 29% of families with children. Now, that's pretty serious.
Well, now to Megan Sandal. When we talked to her, by the way, I was in my office here in Vancouver, Canada.
Hi, guys. Hi, David. Hi, Daniel.
I was in my office in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and Megan was in her dining room,
I think. Good. How are you?
In the Boston area.
And I started by asking her, please take us into your GROW clinic at Boston Medical Center. What does a hunger clinic look like?
In some ways, it looks like a regular clinic. Right? You walk in and, a medical assistant takes you from the waiting room and takes you to get weighed and get measured, right? And then you're put into the room and you're waiting and then the doctor comes to see you. But that's where, in some ways, the picture changes, right?
Uh-huh.
Because when you walk into the room, you see this really cute, what you think is a 12-month-old. But it turns out it's a 2-year-old. It's a 2-year-old that hasn't outgrown their 12-month-old clothes yet.
Wow.
And I think that's a picture that people are always surprised. They're like, well, like, how can that child be failing to thrive, right? Which is kind of this really awful named diagnosis, right? Your weight is the first thing that changes, then your height, then your brain. Your brain is protected. Your body is designed to keep your brain intact. But what we see is really cute kids that are chronically malnourished because often for us, they're food insecure. And those kids are honestly failing to thrive because of a lot of societal factors. And so it can't just be a doctor, right? So the GROW clinic, I see patients, but then I have a social worker and I have a nutritionist and I have an outreach worker. And I've got a navigator, and I have a developmental specialist. It's not your usual clinic because we're a team that needs to undo that damage.
We want to get into what you do about this child and the others. Let's step back a minute and talk about why it is that kids are coming in malnourished, and how extensive is the problem in the United States?
And I just want to add that when I covered Africa and lived there for 4 years, this is what I would see in Africa. Children we'd think were 4 years old and they were 10. So it's kind of shocking to hear about this in the middle of Boston.
First of all, people are shocked that 1 in 5 kids in this country are food insecure, and that's pre-pandemic numbers, right? And it's essentially been unchanged over the last couple of decades. I do think that that to an extent, the clinic that we do is an extreme of that, right? This is a more predominantly low-income clinic that we see at Boston Medical Center, where 40% of the families that we take care of report being food insecure. And honestly, during the pandemic, that rose to closer to two-thirds, like 60 to 70% of our families were reporting kind of not being sure where food was going to be coming from in the next month. Honestly, my patients are a result of policy and system decisions that are now being, I'm treating on an individual basis. And I think that as we start to think about that, a lot of it is honestly just pure economics, right? Families don't earn enough money when they work, or they're not able to work as much as they want because of lack of childcare, or they are having issues because they have now this child who's medically complex and they're not able to work or go to a normal childcare. So there's all these kind of system issues that frankly are part of why there needs to be a grow clinic at Boston Medical Center.
Tell us about some other patients you've seen recently who really, you know, represent the sort of people who come into your clinic.
So one of the things that I think is interesting is we don't talk enough about the lack of childcare in this country and how much work and childcare are mismatched, and how much, to an extent, the lack of childcare is an issue that plays out in babies. And so a mom was working the 4 to 11 shift, and then the dad was working an overnight shift, and then the grandmother was available in the morning time sometimes, and then there was also kind of a neighbor involved when grandma wasn't feeling well. And so this kid was functionally kind of shuttled between four different caregivers during a day. And so the family was fairly food insecure because each one of these jobs was minimum wage, and they were all living in a market rent apartment. So you had one family kind of in one bedroom, another family in another bedroom, and they were all, you know, trying to keep up to date on the rent. And so one of the biggest interventions for this kid was getting them into Head Start.
Mm.
Like, honestly, I don't think I ever got that kid to grow until they got into a dedicated childcare slot that had a schedule and had food provided to them. And so it bought this kid a consistent 8 to 3 during every single day. But I just think it's a great example of, like, if we were parents, we had children that typically had a day that they knew what to expect, right? They knew they woke up in their bed. They woke up at a normal time. They had breakfast at a table. They, you know, maybe went to childcare. They played. They had lunch. They had a nap. They had dinner. They had a nap and maybe went to bed. And what I've learned is I don't assume that for any of my patients.
It's interesting that you tell that story, because I remember many years ago, probably 25 years ago now, I spent a day or two at the Grow Clinic. And I remember that one of the first questions every parent was asked when he or she brought the child in was, what has the child eaten in the last 24 hours or 48 hours.
Interesting.
And very often, the caregiver wasn't able to answer that because of this exact situation you describe. So
Megan and Dave, what both of you are saying, you've done much more work on this than I have, Dave, is that hunger or food insecurity is a huge, complicated web of social and economic factors. I mean, it's not one thing or two things or even three or four.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Do you also find now something that was discovered many years ago in a big survey of low-income families, that there is a relationship or a correlation, at least, between underweight kids and families that do not have housing subsidies? So you might be paying 40 to 60% of your income in rent, and that's not optional, obviously. Neither is the electric bill or the heating bill or so forth, so that the part of the budget that gets squeezed is the part for food. Are you seeing that now happening as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of interesting. When Debbie asked me to join the Grow Clinic now about 15 years ago, I actually told her I didn't think I could do it. I didn't know that much about nutrition. My research is on housing and how housing affects kids' health. And what she said to me, she goes, Megan, you know, housing and hunger are the twin demons for low-income kids. And so you need to come and work in the Grow Clinic because I don't know about housing. We need to start to think about it. And in a lot of ways, as we understand it, you know, homelessness is a huge issue. In our clinics, somewhere around, you know, 10 to 20% of the kids we treat are homeless right now. They're in a homeless shelter. And sometimes those homeless shelters are motel rooms sometimes. And it's almost impossible to cook in a motel room. And so Debbie not only founded the Grow Clinic, but she founded a research policy network with other Grow Clinic doctors called Children's Health Watch. And we at Children's Health Watch have showed that when you interview families in that who have a child 0 to 4, you know, somewhere around, you know, a third of them have a form of housing instability, right? Homelessness, multiple moves. So you ask how many places that the child lived in the past year, you know, families will answer three different places the child has lived. So they've moved at least twice. And then this concept of falling behind on rent. Over a quarter of families that are renters will say at some point during the year they fell behind on rent because they just couldn't keep up.
So when we hear these statistics, you know, 40-something million people are food insecure. That's the phrase, food insecure. These are the people you're talking about. These are the millions and millions and millions of people who have these incredibly complicated webs of social, economic problem and family problems.
Exactly. I think when we talk about it, oftentimes we, especially when we're trying to study it, we pull it apart, right? They're food insecure or they're housing unstable or they're energy insecure or they have, say, healthcare cost trade-offs. But the reality is like families are always juggling bills. And so that I think that it's really important for us not to split them apart and do a food insecurity intervention or a housing intervention or an energy. We're really talking about just money.
We are chatting today with Dr. Megan Sandel. She co-directs the Grow Clinic at Boston Medical Center.
Maybe this is the time for a good, full, rich description of the clinic and all of its services, the entire range of services. It's pretty unusual, isn't it, to have a clinic that can provide so many different things.
Let me start with the history, because you can't talk about the Grow Clinic without talking about its founder, Dr. Deborah A. Frank. In many ways, she is an iconic woman. I say that she had kind of three careers. Debbie founded the Grow Clinic 30 years ago around this idea that like, oh, we're just going to be able to treat this for a couple of years and then we'll go out of business. And you know, this is a four-alarm fire for a kid who's not growing. If they're not growing their brain now, they're going to miss out on so much in life.
What is that window? What is that window, that critical window?
So most people will talk about the first 1,000 days as being, and that includes the prenatal period and malnutrition in the prenatal period. And then the first 3 years of life is kind of the critical window. And Debbie always envisioned what now we would call the medical home, right? Like she envisioned that this clinic would be like your family, people that would be able to take care of you. And if you needed transportation, we got you transportation. If you needed a high chair, we bought you a high chair. If you needed help with childcare, we did advocacy for childcare. And so she built kind of this wraparound team. And I think that it still is fairly unusual. I actually checked in with Debbie about how many Grow clinics there are across the country. There probably are only about a dozen that are as dedicated to this particular patient group, right? This is a low income, predominantly, you know, often families of color. And I think that a lot of the other kind of growth and nutrition clinics often are serving, frankly, higher income patients, where they're able to pay for the private nutritionist, they're able to pay for a lot of the issues. But these that are dedicated for this particular low-income patient population, there just aren't that many around the world.
So you're much more than a medical clinic. You're a full-service medical social worker.
It's such an interesting idea around what we consider care these days, right? Like what counts as health care? And I think that oftentimes, just so we're clear, for the Grow Clinic, the only person who bills is the doctor. Medicaid insurance doesn't pay for the social work time. Medicaid insurance doesn't pay for the nutrition time. It doesn't pay for the outreach worker. Sometimes it can pay for the transportation, but it's frankly not as great of a service as sometimes our ability to pay for other transportation. And so we've really, in some ways, redefined care around these different, you know, things that are needed to address the so-called social determinants of health that oftentimes are more predictive to outcomes than the traditional healthcare. And sometimes you think you're treating one problem in the Grow Clinic and you're actually treating a different problem.
Can the Grow Clinic help the parents too? Or is it only the kids with the hunger problems?
For some families, oftentimes what we're actually treating is maternal depression that's manifesting itself in the fact that their kid isn't growing. For example, we saw a patient who the mom was actually still breastfeeding at age 2, and the child, you know, was, you know, severely underweight, the size of a 12-month-old. And what came out was that the mother's brother had been shot and killed, and the mother went into a real depression. And so in her kind of, you know, crying and being really upset, her child would often cry also with her. And the only way to calm the child was to breastfeed. And so the child was essentially on the breast almost continuously. There was like no ability for this mom to soothe this kid in any other way. And the mom really wasn't eating herself. So like you may say, oh, breastfeeding is great. Yeah, breastfeeding is great, except when you're not eating well and then your breast milk isn't that good and then you're not eating anything else. And so this child ended up with severe, severe vitamin deficiencies. Like our kind of GI doctor said, it was like, again, like third world malnutrition. We ended up having to admit her to the hospital because we were so concerned about reintroducing those vitamins in a way that could cause a cardiac arrest. And the only way that we could eventually get this kid to grow was to treat mom's depression such that she could actually say, no, I'm not going to breastfeed you. I want you to eat this. That's where it's kind of like, you know, it's easy to talk about it as a kid issue and not treat it as a full family issue.
And does the Grow Clinic have the ability to treat her depression?
One of the things that our integrated behavioral health kind of approach is having our social workers engage and be able to start some of that journey and then be able to connect them with long-term psychotherapy. She was so frozen in her kind of ability to cope with the world that we had to actually get her into therapy where they went to her house to do the therapy because she wasn't able to go to other clinical sites.
And did the child get better?
We eventually discharged her just in a much better place. In some ways, we're doing a societal service, right? These are kids that if we didn't intervene, wouldn't show up ready to learn in kindergarten, wouldn't be able to go on to college and other things. But it's really about how we dive in during that critical window of time in order to see better outcomes.
As you were talking about some of these issues, I was thinking, but wait a minute, and I know this is kind of naive, but there's all kinds of government programs, right, to help low-income and poor people eat right.
There are government programs to take care of people for food, but they're underfunded. For instance, SNAP. Do you guys know how SNAP is decided, like what the different levels are?
Well, go ahead and explain it, because whatever we know, not everyone listening might.
Yeah. I know nothing, so, and it used to be called food stamps, right?
Yeah, so think about what SNAP stands for, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So it's not meant to be your full food budget. It's meant to be a supplemental food budget. But the problem is most people are so low income that they actually have to use it as their main food budget. And so then it runs out. And then by the end of the month, most families are pretty severely food insecure, especially at the lowest rungs of the program. SNAP is calculated off of what's called the Thrifty Food Plan. And we at Children's Health Watch have published that the real cost of a healthy diet versus that Thrifty Nutrition Plan, it's at least a third to half underfunded. It is grossly underfunding what is a healthy diet, and therefore gets to the micronutrients question. If you want someone to have iron and vitamin D and folate and other things that we know are essential for brain growth, then you have to actually fund the diet that has that. And we don't fund that. So for instance, like one of the healthiest foods would be, say, a rotisserie chicken, right? Many stores sell them for $5. That's forbidden. You can't buy that with SNAP.
Huh? Why?
Because it's a prepared food, and they've decided you're not allowed to do it.
My gosh. And do you also see what you might call indirect results of poverty, that is, food deserts in neighborhoods where families live so that they go to a corner store that doesn't have nutritious fruits and vegetables and that sort of thing? Or it's a long trip to a good supermarket? I mean, is that also part of the problem?
Yeah, it's a great question. So some people have described it more as a food swamp, that you have places to buy food, but the food options in those stores are not necessarily as optimal as what you want. And it's interesting, we actually do exercises with our pediatric residents, right? People who had just graduated from medical school, young doctors learning to be pediatricians. And we actually give them community assignments where they have to go to an address via public transportation and go to a store and walk through the store and see what the store looks like. And what they tend to find is that the fruits and vegetables there are expensive, right? An apple is $1.25. A banana is $1.50. And frankly, the banana and the apple look terrible. They're bruised and old and other things. Versus with that same $1.25, they can buy, you know, like two bags of chip and, you know, three things of juice. And so we subsidize things that have fat and sugar. We do not subsidize fresh fruits and vegetables to the same extent. And
well, what do you mean by that? We subsidize.
Well, the federal government has billions of dollars that they give to both the corn industry that results in corn syrup being so cheap, and it also in the sugar industry that makes sugared beverages so cheap. So milk, like a quart of milk, is $2 to $3. And the similar equivalency of, say, soda is 99 cents.
And Dave told me that you mentioned to him when you chatted on the phone recently that you've had patients who say the problem isn't even always money, that they can't afford stuff. It's that they can't even find whole milk at the stores.
One of the interesting things in the pandemic, we would send a family a gift card and then they would report going to 5 or 6 stores in order to find the whole milk. Or the special, you know, cheese that we were talking about. And I think that's where it becomes really important, where we think about it. It's not just the ability to afford it. It's the availability of that in your neighborhood. So even something as simple as Instacart, right? You know, it was like, oh, well, why couldn't we do Instacart? Well, when you put an order into Instacart and you put the delivery zip code, it ties to the store that's closest to that zip code. And so our social workers, if you can believe it, were literally going to other places to buy food and then dropping it off. And that was how
we
solved
it. Social workers personally?
Yeah.
They became delivery people?
Literally our master's level social workers and our master's level dietitians were doing home delivery during the pandemic because that was the only way we could guarantee that kids were getting the food that we thought they needed to grow.
We're going to hear more from Megan Sandel in Chapter 2 of this podcast. She'll tell us that hunger affects the lives of her patients in unexpected ways.
These are under-recognized sources of a lot of the developmental and behavioral problems that we see often in schools, particularly in inner cities and in rural areas.
Megan Sandel is co-director of the GROW Clinic for Children and Families with Food Insecurity at Boston Medical Center. And that's it for this episode of Two Reporters.
You'll find us on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, or pretty much any leading podcast site. And we hope you'll check out more of our work at tworeporters.org. I'll repeat that, tworeporters.org or tworeporters.net. I'm David Tripler.
And I'm Daniel Zwerdling. Please join us again soon for another episode of Two Reporters. Bye-bye.